It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Yet another Chinese internet equipment manufacturer showing some vulnerabilities, or maybe they're intentional. We'll tell you why you shouldn't worry too much about that recent Fraunhofer report on vulnerabilities in internet routers. And then it's a look at a new Google vulnerability scanning tool they're giving away. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson. Episode 775, recorded Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. Tsunami. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Red Hat OpenShift. Red Hat OpenShift is the Kubernetes platform that provides a trusted foundation for the on-premises, hybrid, and multi-cloud deployments today's enterprises demand. Go to OpenShift.com/security now to check out its features. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by IT Pro TV. Get the most up-to-date professional training with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/security now for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use the code SN30 at checkout. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest news about security, how things work, how to keep yourself safe with this cat right here, our security guru, Steve Gibson from GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Also known as Steve Areno or this cat.
This
or
cat right here, man.
The best we can do on any given week.
No, that's not true. It is the best we can do. Yes.
So we have episode 775 titled Tsunami after Google's latest and extremely useful looking contribution to the open source community. So we're going to wrap up talking about that. I think that will probably be of interest to a lot of our listeners, especially in larger enterprises, which is what it's aimed at. But we got a bunch of stuff to talk about. We're going to look at Mozilla's surprise suspension of their Firefox Send service, Zoom's latest remote code exploit vulnerability, the latest revision of the U.S. Congress's Earn It Act legislation, still working its way, the growing tension with stalkerware apps, a Chinese internet equipment vendor in the hot seat, the challenge of geolocating illegal drone operators, Fraunhofer's report of rampant router vulnerabilities, and also sort of on a lighter note, SpinRite's move toward increasing political correctness for itself. And then we're going to wrap up, as I mentioned, by looking at Tsunami, which looks like another really useful contribution from Google. So a bunch of fun stuff to talk about this week.
Very cool. I'm sad to hear about Firefox Send.
Well, it's going to be back, but it's interesting what happened to it. And that's really where the story is. So, talking about that.
Well, we'll talk about that in just a bit. But first, a word from our sponsor and a name I think you probably all know, Red Hat. Although I have to admit, having used Red Hat Linux for years, Fedora and Mandrake and the original Red Hat, it's more than Linux, of course. Red Hat is a much bigger company. It made its name in Linux. Red Hat Linux was the Linux distro forever. It served thousands of enterprise customers well for over 8 dot releases. Well, what Red Hat did for Linux, they are now doing for container orchestration. And I think a lot of people have heard of the name. I'm going to give them more credit, have heard of the name Red Hat OpenShift. OpenShift's pretty awesome, and I hear a lot of buzz about OpenShift, have been for the last year or so. It combines the best of Kubernetes with additional features like service mesh, operators, serverless, and more. These help developers and sysadmins do their work with greater ease. And something we all love, automation. No downloads or configuration required to get your hands on a cluster. Isn't that great? I need it. Boom, it's on. What's more, the tutorials aren't gated. They're available. Anybody can read them right now. You don't even have to give your contact information. No one's going to email you or call you afterward. And I think, you know, especially in enterprise, that's unusual. It's nice to know Red Hat still has its open, you know, foundation. Red Hat OpenShift. If you want to give it a try, you've heard about it. You've heard the buzz. There's a free interactive learning portal you can play with right now with pre-configured OpenShift instances. So, and all you need is a browser. So it's the easiest way to try it. And again, they're not going to ask for any contact information. You don't have to sign up. You can just, you know, there's no gate. It's wide open, just as it should be. If you want to know more about Red Hat and OpenShift, if you want the best orchestration you can get, Kubernetes Plus, check out its features. OpenShift.com/security now. OpenShift.com/security now. It's from Red Hat. It's got to be good. Red Hat OpenShift at OpenShift.com/security now. Steve?
And lest we forget the picture of the week, thank you, somebody on Twitter, for sending this to me. It's just kind of fun. I'm not sure what country this is where
it's
they
like
have
a college campus, actually.
Oh,
I bet
it does look like kind of like Harvard in the background.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. And it's or Colorado, because I see the snow stick attached to the fire hydrant.
I was thinking that was a snow stick. Yeah, yes, yeah. Exactly. Although it's not I thought snow sticks were normally on along the side of the road, right? This looks like it's
on the path. You also need to know where the hydrant is if it's buried in the snow.
Like a sidewalk.
But anyway, you may be able to find the hydrant, but don't try to use the emergency phone.
So there's a phone stuck over, looks like an empty hole in this kind of very modern looking structure. It just says, as if you wouldn't know, it says emergency phone not installed. And then the lower half of the note, please do not have an emergency at this location.
Definitely so, campus humor. Definitely.
Yeah. That does seem apropos.
Yeah.
So if someone were to go to send.firefox.com at the moment, they would be greeted by the little screenshot that I have at the top of the security news of our show notes, which reads, Firefox Send is temporarily unavailable while we work on product improvements. We appreciate your patience while we make the Firefox Send experience better. Hmm. And Leo, I think you did just go there, didn't you?
I did, yes.
And there it is.
Well, that's too bad, because I really love Firefox Send. It's such a good idea.
It's my go-to, yes, it's become my go-to file sharing service. The good news, it'll be back. The bad news is why it went away. Just to remind our listeners, we've talked about it before. It allows files of up to 1 gigabyte if you're not signed in, or 2.5 gigabytes if you are, to be locally encrypted in the browser, optionally password protected so that only the recipient is able to retrieve and decrypt the sent file. You get retention controls allowing the sender to set the time, that is the duration, and or a download count after which that content will expire from the Firefox Send cloud and be removed. Unfortunately, as with anything that is simple, free, and effective, you know, like think email, it's also subject to abuse by nefarious forces. The bad guys also love Firefox Send because it lets them generate short-term links based on good-looking trusted domains for sharing arbitrary evilware to unwitting victims. So thanks to Firefox Send, the bad guys don't need to set up their own file sharing server, you know, and like try to get a legitimate looking URL domain. They don't have to worry about making sure the URLs expire automatically. Mozilla does that for them. and links that only work once create an extra challenge for security researchers, because even if the malicious URL is captured in a log, by then it's probably been used. So it's not possible to go back and obtain the original because it's been removed already. And of course, since the IP is one of Mozilla's servers, it's not one that anyone wants to just put a blanket block on. You know, and I was going to say they wouldn't want to blacklist it, but I'm working to be better. Over the past few months, Firefox Send, it turns out, has been used increasingly to store payloads for all sorts of cybercrime operations, from ransomware through financial crime, banking trojans, spyware, and used to target human rights defenders. Fin7, Revil, also known as Sodino Kibi, URSniff, which is also the DreamBot network, and ZLoader are just some of the malware gangs and strains that have been seen hosting payloads using Firefox Send. As a consequence, the cybersecurity industry has finally tipped its collective hat to Mozilla for suspending what has become a widely used and unfortunately now widely abused service. You know, Mozilla didn't just say, oh, you know, we recognize there's a problem. We'll be considering some changes in the future. They just shut it down. They said, okay, we're just going to stop making this available until we can, you know, upgrade it. Cybersecurity researchers have suggested various changes to strengthen the service. One is to add a report abuse button so that flagging or killing malicious links could be made much more quick and easy. What Mozilla said in their statement about this, they said, before relaunching, we will be adding an abuse reporting mechanism to augment the existing feedback form, and we will require all users wishing to share content using Firefox Send to sign in with a Firefox account. So it's sad that once again, we see the internet's inherent anonymity being abused and then having to be restricted. You know, it was cool to be able to send up to 1 gig with a 24-hour expiration without needing an account with Mozilla, you know, even though I have one. But just as Zoom was forced to limit what they would allow to be done with full anonymity, so too now has Mozilla. And as we know, even requiring an account is not a very high bar. And my sense is it's not going to be very effective, but at least it will help a bit. And it will help Mozilla to say, hey, you know, we've done all we can. We're doing, you know, we're doing all that we can do. But, you know, in light of all this, of everything we see going around us, I will make a prediction that in some future, and, you know, not tomorrow, not even soon, maybe not during our lifetime, but I'll bet that some set of abuse-prone services, maybe anything that generates rather than consumes content, will end up requiring some form of affirmative, probably government-issued, verifiable identity. In that possible, and I would argue probable, eventual future, it will be permissible to browse and read and consume content anonymously. But any public content will be probably be traceable back to its source. You know we're not there today and it won't happen soon, but I'll bet it happens eventually. Or maybe as a sort of an interim step, content will be flagged as being from a verified source or not, sort of like, you know, verified Twitter identities that you know, you would allow users to choose what level of veracity and or risk they wish to accept, or make it just very, very visible that something is from a verified source or not. You know, we have that with HTTP versus HTTPS. We had the lock icon saying that this was secure. Initially, it was to protect users from submitting content over an insecure link. Then later, it became an aspect of reputation. It was the reputation was better. Then, of course, as we know, security became just a given for all websites, so that now if a site doesn't have a TLS certificate, it's like it's said to be insecure. But in any event, they had to pull that, Mozilla had to pull it down. They're going to change the way it works and then bring it back up. Maybe they'll do more things. We don't really know. But, it had to go away because it was being abused. So sort of sad to see that happen. And to sort of see the dream of an anonymous internet sort of slowly disappearing, being chipped away at. And speaking of Zoom, they fixed a new remote code execution flaw that was turned out to be affecting Windows 7 and earlier systems. And it was a bit of an odd chain of events. A private researcher who wishes to remain anonymous and still is quietly reported his discovery of an unknown remote code execution vulnerability in the Zoom client, which affects all versions of Windows up to and including 7, and probably it's likely matching Windows Server 2008 R2. He did not report it to Zoom. For some reason, he reported to Acros Security, who are those zero patch guys, the guys that create the little quickie, really very small patches of Windows components of the Windows operating system and do so immediately, often beating Microsoft to an official patch by weeks, sometimes even longer. So Acros, the zero patch guys, knew about this. They confirmed and reproduced the problem, including creating a proof of concept demo video of this. Then they privately and responsibly disclosed the problem to Zoom. So last Thursday, July 9th, Zero Patch blogged about the discovery. They said, earlier this week, a security researcher shared a remote code execution zero-day vulnerability. And I have zero-day in quotes for a reason I'll come back to in a moment. They said a zero-day vulnerability in the Zoom client for Windows with our team. The vulnerability allows a remote attacker to execute arbitrary code on a victim's computer where the Zoom client for Windows, and they said any currently supported version, is installed by getting the user to perform some typical action, such as opening a document. No security warning is shown to the user in the course of attack. The researcher, who wants to keep their identity private, stated that they did not report the vulnerability to Zoom either directly or through a broker, but would not object to us reporting it to Zoom. We analyzed the issue and determined it to only be exploitable on Windows 7 and older systems. While Microsoft's official support for Windows 7 ended this January, there are still millions of home and corporate users prolonging its useful service life with Microsoft's extended security updates or with Zero Patch, which of course is their product. They said, we documented the issue along with several attack scenarios and reported it to Zoom earlier today, along with a working proof of concept and recommendations for fixing. Should a bug bounty be awarded by Zoom, it shall be waived in favor of a charity of the researcher's choice. On the micropatching side, they said, we were able to quickly create a micropatch that removes the vulnerability in 4 different places in the code. The micropatch was then ported from the latest version of the Zoom client for Windows, which is 5.1.2, to previous five versions back to 5.0.3, released on May 17th of 2020. The Zoom client features a fairly persistent auto-update functionality that is likely to keep home users updated unless they really don't want to be. However, enterprise admins often like to keep control of updates and may stay a couple of versions behind, especially if no security bugs were fixed in the latest versions, they said, which is currently the case. They finished, our micro-patches have already been released and distributed to all online OPatch agents, or zero-patch agents. Zoom users with zero-patch installed are therefore no longer affected by this issue. According to our guidelines, we're providing these micro-patches to everyone for free until Zoom has fixed the issue or made a decision not to fix it. To minimize the risk of exploitation on systems without zero patch, we're not publishing details on this vulnerability until Zoom has fixed the issue or made a decision not to fix it, or until such details have become public knowledge in any other way. And then, in an update to that blog posting yesterday, Monday, they amended the posting to add, update 7.13, Zoom only took one day to issue a new version of the client for Windows that fixes this vulnerability, which is remarkable. We've reviewed their fix and can confirm that it efficiently resolves the vulnerability. With an official vendor fix available to all users, we have made our micro patches for this pro only according to our guidelines. Meanwhile, and pro only meaning the paid for zero patch. Meanwhile, after issuing micro patches for this issue targeted at Zoom clients for Windows versions 5.03 to 5.12, we noticed a lot of our users being on all of these versions despite Zoom's highly persistent update mechanism, which, as an aside, I think is interesting that for whatever reason, people are not staying current despite the fact that Zoom is pushing people. Although that the oldest one, 503, is only May, so it's not like it's really old, but still. They said, we had expected most users to be on version 5.1.2, but this indicates many users may still be on even older Zoom client versions. We therefore ported our micropatch to the remaining supported versions of the Zoom client back to 5.0.0, 0.0.1, and 0.0.2. They said, we're now covering all vulnerable supported clients. So for our listeners, we want to make sure that they're keeping their Zoom clients current. I'm not a Zoom user, so I'm not having experience what's going on with updating. But for what it's worth, you want to be on 5.1.3, I think, or later, since Zoom has an aggressive auto update policy in place and a facility. I don't understand why people aren't already clear. The Zero Patch guys have a bunch of Q&A on their blog posting about the vulnerability, and I put a link to the blog in the show notes. So anyone who's interested can check out the link. But I'll also note that as an industry, we appear to be suffering a bit of definition drift. This was covered by the tech press as a 0 day. Now, maybe that's because the tech press just covered what the zero patch people said. And I guess the zero patch wants to sort of call things a 0 day. But a 0 day is defined as a vulnerability that is first discovered as a result of its being actively exploited in the wild. It's considered of the highest possible importance and priority specifically because it's already loose. And, you know, and like by the time it's first seen, it's under exploitation. And so, you know, these zero patch guys came along because they wanted to fix it immediately, which is cool. You know, they were zero patching 0 days, but now they're patching things that are not 0 days, and they're calling them 0 days, which doesn't make them 0 days. So, you know, I'm seeing this in the tech press, like, you know, that here, as far as we know, a vulnerability which was identified but has never been abused even once is being called a 0 day, but it's not. It's just a discovery, responsibly reported and remediated before, as far as we know, it was ever abused. That's the way all regular vulnerabilities are discovered and reported responsibly, right? They're not 0 days. So that's the best case, and it's happening all the time. That's what HackerOne has made their business model. So since the term 0 day has a very specific and important meaning, I'm going to work not to promulgate this misuse of the definition. And, you know, I hope that as an industry, we will keep from being overreactive in our responses to this, because it's a useful and good definition that I think we need to hold to. We have a revision of the Earn It Act bill, take two. We'll recall that the Earn It is the rather tortured acronym for eliminating abusive and rampant neglect of Interactive Technologies Act of 2020. It's been revised just a couple days ago in an attempt to collect, presumably, the votes necessary to get it passed through Congress, although it's not clear to me how it achieves that. I struggled through a bunch of legalese and mumbo jumbo in an attempt to distill what has changed about the bill in its amendment. And as near as I can see, what the bill has changed is definitely not for the better. The original bill would have impaneled a 19-person federal commission, predominantly seated with law enforcement representatives, who would have had the power to determine whether this or that website was, quote, in compliance. And of course, that phrase is chilling. And what they would be determining was whether the website was in compliance with the committee's determination of best practices, whatever that was, which if they were in compliance, if the site was in compliance, would entitle them to retain the legal protections that all websites currently enjoy and depend upon under Section 230 for hosting user-provided content. But that was before. Now, this 19-person federal commission has been abandoned, with the new bill handing over. Oh, my goodness.
It's just Bill Barr now. Just Bill Barr. That's all.
Well, actually, he's in the picture still,
yeah.
But it's even worse. It hands over the power to the 50 individual states of our union. Lord help us.
Are they trying to make this more unworkable? Is that what they're trying to do?
Oh, Leo. And I'll just note that we've seen how well allowing each state to determine its own course of action has worked with what has become of the COVID-19 catastrophe fiasco mess. So they said, yes, let's just let every state decide to do what it wants. Under this newly revised bill, should Earn It ever become law, individual state lawmakers will be able to create new laws allowing private lawsuits and criminal prosecutions against internet platforms as long as they say that their purpose is to stop crimes against children. The EFF summarizes the intent of Section 230 as follows. The EFF wrote, "The whole idea behind Section 230 is to make sure that you are responsible for your own speech online, not someone else's. Currently, they said, if a state prosecutor wants to bring a criminal case related to something said or done online, or a private lawyer wants to sue, in nearly all cases, the prosecutor has to seek out the actual speaker. They can't just haul a website owner into court because of their user's actions. But that will change if Earnit passes." They said Section 230 protections enable the internet as we know it. Despite the politicized attacks on Section 230 from both left and right, the law actually works fine. It's not a shield for big tech. It's a shield for everyone who hosts online conversations. It protects small messaging and email services and every blog's comments section. Once websites lose Section 30 protections, they'll take drastic measures to mitigate their legal exposure. That will limit free speech across the internet. They'll shut down forums and comment sections and cave to bogus claims that particular users are violating the rules without doing a proper investigation. They finish, the EFF says, "We've seen false accusations succeed in silencing users time and again in the copyright space, and even used to harass innocent users. If Earnit passes, the range of possibilities for false accusations and censorship will expand." And they also said later, they said, "When we say the original Earnit was a threat to encryption, we're not guessing. We know that a commission controlled by Attorney General William Barr will try to ban encryption, because Barr has said many times that he thinks encrypted services should be compelled to create backdoors for police. The manager's amendment approved by the committee today doesn't eliminate this problem. It just empowers over 50 jurisdictions to follow Barr's lead in banning encryption." So with the amended bill, it will only take one state to inspire a wave of prosecutions and lawsuits against online platforms. And just as some federal law enforcement agencies have declared they're opposed to encryption, so have some state and local police. The previous version of the bill suggested that if online platforms want to keep their Section 230 immunity, they would need to earn it, as we know, by following the dictates of an unelected government commission. But the new text doesn't even give them a chance. The bill's sponsors simply dropped the earn from earn it. Website owners, especially those that enable encryption, will no longer be able to earn their immunity from liability for user content under the new bill. They'll have to defend themselves in court as soon as a single state-sponsored prosecutor, or even just a lawyer in private practice, decides that offering end-to-end encryption was a sign of indifference towards crimes against children. And that's the way it's probably going to play out. So we'll see what happens. It turns out that stalkerware is becoming more of a thing and is on more people's radar, which actually is probably good. Stalkerware has grown to become enough of a problem that Google, Apple, AV makers, and even the Federal Trade Commission have been pushing back on this growing application segment. The term stalkerware refers to spyware apps designed to allow an abusive partner in a relationship to spy on their significant other by installing spyware onto the other smartphone without their knowledge or consent. Sadly, stalkerware is also sometimes referred to as spouseware. It turns out that although it's not highly popular, its use has been been steadily increasing this last decade, largely enabled by the proliferation of smartphones that are able to host said malware, or grayware at least, in another person's phone. It allows partners to keep tabs on their partners at all times by tracking the phone. And the ready availability of these stalkerware products in official app stores has increased the visibility of them, opening them up to millions of potential users. According to statistics gathered by Kaspersky, the number of users who had stalkerware-like apps installed on their Android devices increased from 40,386 known devices in 2018 to more than 67,500 one year later. So better than a 50% increase in 2019. So the market's not massive, but it is slimy. According to independent antivirus testing lab AV Comparatives and the EFF, detection rates for stalkerware applications on Android and Windows devices have slowly improved. As the issue is gaining more press coverage and security vendors are moving in to address the growing risk that this is creating. You know, we've touched on this in the past. You know, the apps are not technically malware. They sort of fall into that gray zone where, you know, they're benign and, but, you know, they're, you know, slimeware, I guess you could call it. So against this backdrop, we have Google's announcement just last week of an important coming update to what they call their enabling dishonest behavior policy for advertising across apparently, you know, all of their properties. They basically created a 1 month notice or notification. They said in August 2020, so next month, the Google Ads Enabling Dishonest Behavior Policy, is that an acronym for GAEDB? No, I guess they didn't even try. Google Ads Enabling Dishonest Behavior Policy will be updated to clarify restrictions on advertising for spyware and surveillance technology. The updated policy will prohibit the promotion of products or services that are marketed or targeted with the express purpose of tracking or monitoring another person or their activities without their authorization. This policy will apply globally, and we will begin enforcing this policy update on August 11th, 2020. Spyware and technology used for intimate partner surveillance, including but not limited to spyware and malware that can be used to monitor texts, phone calls, or browsing history, GPS trackers, and specifically marketed to spy or track someone without their consent or promotion, or promotion of surveillance equipment, cameras, audio recorders, dash cams, nanny cams, marketed with the express purpose of spying, is covered. This does not include private investigation services or products or services designed for parents to track or monitor their underage children. Violations of this policy will not lead to immediate account suspension without prior warning. A warning will be issued at least 7 days prior to any suspension of an account. Please review this policy update to determine whether or not any of your ads fall in scope of the policy. And if so, remove those ads before August 11th, 2020. So I guess they're not saying they're going to remove the apps themselves, but they're just going to say no to any advertising of these sorts of things globally across all of their products. So I say yay to that. And Leo, I say I think it's time for our second sponsor.
I say yay to that. Our show today brought to you by, I really say yay to this, the Thinkst Canary. We love our canary. Oh, this is such a good thing. Those Thinkst guys are super smart. Really, really talented. In fact, for more than a decade, they've been teaching companies and governments how to hack their systems. And they've learned a lot. They know how hackers work, and that's the design behind, the thinking behind the Thinkst Canary. This is a little canary I have here in my office. You see, it's just a little doohick. He looks like a small external hard drive, maybe. But it's got a lot of power. Inside this Thinkst Canary can be a variety of things. You can set it up. It's a honeypot, so you can set it up to look like as mine is, a Synology NAS or a Windows 2000 server or anything. A SCADA device, even down to the MAC address and the login pages, they all are identical to the real thing. Hackers won't know the difference. You can even enroll them in your directory server. You can put them on Active Directory. So when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away. You're instantly notified. Look, data breaches are clearly on the rise. They are a real problem. What was the company that just had to admit? Was it Verizon? Somebody just had to admit that, it wasn't a million records. It was 143 million records breached. Who was that? I can't remember. I just saw that today. These things are embarrassing for the company. They're bad for your customers. They're bad for your business. You want to, as soon as an attacker is inside your network, you want to know. And that's what the canary does. It attracts them like bees to honey. And then let you know. And when you do need to be alerted, you know, Canary will give you the option of deciding how you'd like to be told. Email, text message, on your console, Slack, webhooks, syslog, their API. The alerts are dead simple and easy to work with. They conform to your needs, not the other way around. You won't be inundated either because you'll get one key alert that tells you exactly what's going on and what you can do about it. Look, there are two things all companies should know when it comes to data breaches. Hackers will always take the path of least resistance. Usually that means getting in through your employees. So, you know, you got to be aware, but it also it takes on average, and this is the really depressing stat, 191 days for a company to realize, oh, there's been a data breach. And that's what this is all about. This is all about letting you know, hey, there's somebody in the network and they're up to no good. You know, if somebody logs in, for a perfect example, if somebody logs in to my, quote, Synology NAS here, I will immediately get an alert with a login, which can sometimes tell me something if they use an email that's known to the network, for instance. And I can act on it instantly. It's only happened once, which is great since we've put the canary in here a couple of years ago. And it was an external device that Megan was reviewing. It was a external hard drive. I guess it was more like a NAS drive. But it was, for some reason, it was going out looking at the whole network. I'm sure it had a good reason. I didn't want that. And as soon as we saw that had happened and we saw the IP address, boom, we shut her down. Shut her down. And that's exactly what you want. Oh, it wasn't Verizon. I'm sorry. It was MGM. And this is a perfect example. They first said, oh, there were 10.6 million customer records released. They just today said, maybe 142 million customer records. That's a perfect example of a company not even knowing what's going on. You know, that's so bad for your business, for your reputation. The canary looks identical to something that you might really have on your network, a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, a Windows server. Attackers can't tell the difference. They don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable and appealing. You can configure it. It's so easy. The interface is so easy to configure it to whatever you want it to be. You can change it anytime you want. You can even create canary tokens. I love this. These are files, fake files, but they look real on your network, PDFs or Word documents. I have a few spread around, like an Excel spreadsheet named Payroll Data. that I, you know, squirreled around. The minute somebody tries to open it, boom, go it phones home. It lets me know. That's awesome. These guys are brilliant. They've been doing this for a long time. They know exactly how hackers break into networks. These canaries are deployed all over the world, 7 continents. Yeah, all of them. They're one of the best tools against data breaches, and they're very affordable, very easy to use. You don't have to be a wizard to set them up. You can set up a honeypot in minutes. Now, you could have one. Sometimes companies have, big banks have hundreds. I'll give you an example, though, of pricing for 5 canaries. You get your own hosted console. You get upgrades. If a canary breaks at any time, they just send you a new one. No big deal. Support and maintenance, $7,500 a year for 5 canaries. Except if you use the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off, $750 savings. And you get that not just the first year, but forever, as long as you have your canary. We know you're going to love the canary, but if for any reason you're not happy, you can always return it. There's a 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. Of course, they know nobody ever returns these because they're great. They just sit there quietly waiting for somebody to snoop around on the network. I think this is one of the best security tools you can have. In fact, if you go to canary.tools/love, you can see in real time tweets, people tweeting about their canary and how much they love it. A lot of big companies use these. A lot of small ones, a lot of governments. Canary.tools/twit. Use twit in the How Did You Hear About Us box and you will save 10%. Honeypots that are easy to configure, easy to set up, give you the alerts that matter. That's the Thinkst Canary. THINK, like think, st. THINKST, canaries. It's at canary, CANARY, .tools/twit. Thank you, Thinkst. Big supporters of the network, and especially of you, Steve. And we're really glad to have them aboard. Back
and
to you.
Thinkst is fun to say.
It is fun to say. They're really, really smart, great people. I really like that company. On we go with the show.
So, I don't know what to think about internet appliances from China that are having a problem. We have a Chinese internet equipment vendor very much in the hot seat. You know, and it's not as if it's not possible, just as possible for domestic vendors, you know, in the U.S. to deliberately plant backdoors in their products. As we know, the security industry remains quite suspicious of our own American investigative services, the NSA and the CIA. We have quite strong circumstantial evidence that both organizations are developers of powerful computer subversion and surveillance technology. I think, you know, all large nation states have such. And to this day, we suspect that the NSA may have influenced the design of the default source of entropy used in RSA's earlier BeSafe crypto API. And they didn't influence it in a way that made it any stronger, by the way. So, you know, it's certainly not fair to, I think, to paint all of China and anything that comes out of China with a broad red brush. When we discover that a particular Chinese vendor, excuse me, is apparently shipping very high-end networking equipment containing multiple, apparently deliberate backdoors.
And it's not Huawei.
And it's not, exactly, Huawei. although now I guess there may be two. But this one, we have absolute proof of. This is not like, whoops. So without drawing any conclusion or rendering any judgment, here's the story. Last week, 2 security researchers, Pierre Kim and Alexander Torres, very clearly documented their discovery of 7 vulnerabilities in the firmware of what's known as FTTH OLT devices. I'll explain that in a second, manufactured by the Chinese equipment vendor C-Data. And these are not consumer products. So it's not a company name known to us. But apparently these guys are – it's very popular stuff. There's a lot of their equipment around. FTTH stands for fiber to the home, and OLT stands for optical line termination. So taken together, FTTH-OLT refers to networking equipment that allows ISPs to bring fiber optic cables as close to the end users as possible, transiting that so-called last mile to our doorstep. These devices are the termination on a fiber optics network. They convert data from an optical line into an Ethernet cable connection that's plugged in at the end user's home, in data centers or business centers. And they appear all over an ISP's network due to their crucial role. So this makes them one of today's most widespread types of networking devices at the high end. And they're situated in millions of network termination endpoints all over the globe. Not necessarily C-datas, but these sorts of things. These FTTH OLT devices. So Pierre and Alexander confirmed the vulnerabilities by performing a static code analysis of the latest firmware running on two of CData's devices. But due to the common internal architecture shared by the entire similar family of devices, they believe that the same vulnerabilities impact 27 other of the company's FTTH OLT models, which run the same or very similar firmware. So a total of 29 different model devices. Their full report is up now on GitHub, and I've got a link in the show notes for anyone who wants more. But the seven vulnerabilities are about as bad as it gets. By far the worst and most disturbing of the seven is the presence of Telnet backdoor accounts hard-coded into the firmware. Yeah, you heard that right. Backdoor Telnet accounts hard-coded into the firmware. Or as they say, that's not a bug, it's a feature. And yes, it gets worse. The Telnet accounts are on the WAN side interface. They allow anyone who knows the hard-coded credentials to connect to the device using any Telnet client running on the device's WAN interface. That is a Telnet client on the internet that is able to access the WAN interface. Pierre and Alexander said that the accounts granted intruders full administrator command line interface, CLI, access. Through their static analysis of the firmware of the two devices, they uncovered four username password combinations hidden in the CData firmware. Those are, and I'm sorry to be like that, these are known because, as we'll get to in a minute, they have not disclosed this responsibly, which makes this a whole lot worse. So, username Suma, S-U-M-A 123, password Panger, P-A-N-G-E-R 123, username Debug, password Debug 124, username Root, password Root 126. Username guest with an empty password, believe it or not. And this initial backdoor command line interface then allows access to exploit additional vulnerabilities. For example, they said that an intruder could also exploit a second bug to list credentials in clear text through the Telnet command line for all other device administrators, that is, the ones that are officially created. The credentials could then be used at a later point in case the backdoor account was removed in a subsequent firmware update. A third vulnerability allowed the attacker, or just like the interloper, because it's not much of an attack when you log in with an open telnet port, to execute shell commands with root privileges from any command line account. A fourth bug was discovered in the same telnet server running on the WAN interface. The researcher said that this server could be abused, that using this additional bug, the server could be abused to crash the FTTH OLT device. Since the server was running by default on the WAN interface, this bug could be used to sabotage an ISP's network if they're not filtering and blocking incoming traffic upstream of the FTTH OLT devices. But the devices also run a web server, of course they do, that's included to power the device's management web interface. Here, they found the fifth bug by downloading 6 text files from this web server. An attacker could get their hands on clear text account credentials for the device's web interface, the telnet server, and the SNMP management interface. And in case any of the passwords are in an encrypted, and let's put that in air quotes, format, you'll see in a minute, that's not a problem either, because all credentials are secured by XORing them against a fixed known string. That string is in the show notes, asterisk, lowercase j, 7a, left paren, uppercase l, and so on. It's in the show notes. So if you were to retrieve an encrypted password, not a problem. Just XOR it with this string, and you will see what the user originally typed in. And last but not least, the two researchers who pointed out that all management interfaces on the tested devices ran in clear text mode. In other words, HTTP, not HTTPS, Telnet instead of SSH, and so on. They said this opened devices and the ISPs that use them to easy man-in-the-middle attacks, of course, because anybody who was able to sniff any traffic would see everything going back and forth, you know, unencrypted telnet logons, even if they were being used. So on top of all this, which is really bad news for anyone who has purchased any of these devices anywhere in the world, as we know, responsible disclosure is the norm. But Pierre and Alexander are sure that they cannot explain what they have uncovered as inadvertent mistakes. And frankly, I have to agree with them. That's how do you possibly explain this? So they published their complete and detailed findings without notifying the vendor, because the nature of what they have found, they felt, could only be explained as a deliberate backdoor functionality, intentionally placed into the firmware by the vendor. This is not something that is like on and can be turned off. These telnet strings are embedded in the firmware. They also noted that identifying all vulnerable devices may be a problem for ISPs, as some of the vulnerable equipment appears to have been sold as white-labeled product under different brands, including OptiLink, V-SOL, CN, or V-SOL-CN, and BLIY, and perhaps others. Now, I sympathize with their presumed outrage and their feelings, but doing what they did is still hugely irresponsible. Disclosure is not made responsibly to protect the vendor of the malfunctioning software, or hardware. Disclosure is made responsibly to protect the users of the malfunctioning product. So no matter whether or not this company's products may have been deliberately backdoored, and I would have to agree, it sure does look like they have been, the only responsible thing to do is to inform them in private of what has now been found and give them a fixed hard deadline to update their product's firmware, remove all discovered problems, and send out urgent notices to all their customers and their OEMs, their resellers, informing them of their urgent need to update the firmware. And then, whether or not the company complies by the deadline, only then, after having given them a reasonable chance of fixing this and getting the patches out to all of their customers who are vulnerable, only then go public with the details. Instead, what they have done really does create a huge mess. Now we have presumably, you know, who knows how many tens of thousands of pieces of high-end networking gear spread around the world, located in crucial networking positions that cannot be readily taken offline. And if there are 29 different makes and models of these things, there are probably some that are very old. So, you know, that who knows how much management they're even getting any longer. But still, I mean, this was a bad original sin. But, you know, going public with this is, you know, no matter the outrage, it can never be responsible. It's really irresponsible. So now everyone, all the bad guys in the world, know exactly how to exploit these devices. And the devices, I mean, it's not, doesn't take any, you know, any cleverness. They're all immediately exploitable. I imagine there will be scans across the internet for telnet ports using these newly released credentials to see what that is publicly available can be found. And if they're not exposed, if some of these things are not exposed to the public, then, you know, they're on internal LANs and there will be new scans for these usernames and passwords. You know, these guys could have been heroes, but that's not the path that they chose. So, you know, this sort of does bring us to an important point, which is how do purchasers of networking equipment know what they are getting? It is a huge temptation to purchase an inexpensive piece of equipment from a foreign supplier who may be offering a lot of functionality at a very attractive price. But, you know, first of all, I would be a little skeptical of the fact that it isn't using HTTPS and it isn't using SSH. I mean, it does have the feeling of a bargain basement piece of equipment. But again, I don't have any sense of scale for how widely deployed these 29 different model number devices may be. But boy, you know, buyer beware in this instance. Wow. And again, yes, it's a Chinese vendor. Maybe that, you know, factor that in as a signal in a complex decision about where you want to buy your equipment. As you said, Leo, it's not Huawei, but it's CData, and we can now, you know, prop them up against Huawei and say, well, okay, you know, I don't really remember whether Huawei has been found definitively doing something wrong like this, or just, you know, having a strong suspicion of being a bad actor. But wow,
it depends who you ask.
Wow,
a lot of governments say Huawei is as bad as this, but you ask. But the problem, so are you better if you buy American-made And can you get American-made? Where do you get that?
Cisco's been having a huge bunch of problems recently. Yeah. You know, they've been having remote code executions and emergency patches. Nothing this egregious. I mean, this is just in your face, awful.
Well, and that's the question: is it error or intentional? Right?
It's hard. This has to be. This has to be deliberate.
Yeah.
You don't embed telnet access, undocumented telnet usernames and passwords in the firmware without it. And they could say, oh, it was just meant for, we shipped debugging kernels by mistake. We never meant to do that.
I mean, there'd be more subtle ways to do it if you really wanted to do it than putting a telnet in there. But I don't know. You know what? So, encrypt everything. Trust no one. Encrypt everything that goes over the network. Yeah. Zero knowledge. Zero trust.
We all know what a problem locating the sources of remotely piloted consumer drones can be when they're operating illegally in the vicinity of a commercial airport. Those little guys, those little drones can and have caused serious disruptions in aviation because a drone cannot be allowed to strike the intake of a jet engine. That would be very bad. Birds are bad. Drones are worse. So as with anonymous postings on the internet, drone operators have been able to operate under the assumption that they cannot be caught because they cannot be located. They're able to operate a good distance away. And with today's camera-equipped drones, they no longer even need line of sight to their little vehicles. But if they could be reliably located, the word of mouth would spread and the problem would be largely resolved. A few highly publicized arrests and the game would change. So far, the only solutions that has been applied is sort of the obvious one. Surround locations where drones pose a real hazard with radio receiving stations tied back to a central control point and attempt to use the radio frequency emissions from a drone operator's transmitter to geolocate that device. Now, in an empty field in the middle of Nebraska, that might work well. But a busy commercial airport in any modern urban center turns out to be a very different problem. The air is hugely contaminated, not only with avionic radio frequencies, including high-power radar, but also the typical ground clutter that you have with cellular phones, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, IoT, and all manner of other radio frequency generating equipment. And to further complicate matters, drone operation radio signals can have short duration. Their frequency usually hops over most of the band, and they have relatively low power. Huh. So, Leo, to address this problem, our industrious academics from Israel's Ben Gurion University of the Negev, who we're often referring to, have been performing some research and have just publicized a new paper titled, "Can the Operator of a Drone Be Located by Following the Drone's Path?" For anyone who's curious, I have a link in the show notes. They said that, well, so far, I did read enough of it to get a sense for it. I won't go into great detail, but I'll summarize that their work so far has been with simulations. Their underlying supposition appears to be holding. The path of a drone being remotely controlled by someone from a distance will inherently contain clues about the location from which that person is viewing the drone. Just a simple example is that the drone's motion along the line of sight to the viewer will be much less obvious to that viewer than any motion to their line of sight to the drone. So it's reasonable to suppose that this might influence the drone's path. Unfortunately, this system assumes that the drone is being piloted visually from a remote location and not using an FPV drone-mounted camera. So the application might be somewhat limited in practice, but they have trained up neural networks and have been able to predict with 78% accuracy the operator's remote location, knowing only the drone's flight path. So I thought that was pretty cool. I just wanted to share this since I thought it was interesting and clever and not at all immediately obvious. And also since it was new work from our industrious academics at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. We have a report from Fraunhofer Institute. Or Fraunhofer Institute.
Oh, yeah, this thing was terrifying.
I know. Yeah. And ridiculous, unfortunately.
Oh, well, oh good. Yeah, that's a relief.
Yes, that's the good news.
Okay.
So the report's title was Rampant Router Insecurities. And it's not what it appears. The tech press has been hyperventilating over a 25-page report from, as I said, the Fraunhofer Institute, Home Router Security Report 2020. So just the executive summary. It's pretty quick, gives you a taste for this. And this is, of course, what the tech press jumped on. They wrote, this report analyzes 127 different routers for private use developed by seven different large vendors selling their products in Europe. An automated approach was used to check the router's most recent firmware versions for five security-related aspects. We were able to extract completely 117 of the 127 firmware images. Four firmware images could be extracted partly, and six firmware images could not be extracted at all. 116 of 127, that is 91% of the devices, are powered by Linux. One was powered by ThreadX and another by Ecos. The security aspects addressed in this report are: when were the devices updated the last time? Which operating system versions are used? And how many known critical vulnerabilities affect these operating system versions? Which exploit mitigation techniques do the vendors use, and how often do they activate these techniques? Do the firmware images contain private cryptographic key material? Are there any hard-coded credentials? And they said, our results are alarming. There is no router without flaws. 46 routers did not get any security update within the last year. Many routers are affected by hundreds of known vulnerabilities. Even if the routers got recent updates, many of these known vulnerabilities are not fixed. What makes matters worse is that exploit mitigation techniques are used rarely. Some routers have easily crackable or even well-known passwords that cannot be changed by the user. Most firmware images provide private cryptographic key material. This means whatever they try to secure with a public-private crypto mechanism is not actually secure at all. Nonetheless, they wrote, vendors seem to prioritize security differently. Especially AVM, that must be a European manufacturer, does a better job than the other vendors regarding most of the security aspects. However, AVM routers are not flawless. ASUS and Netgear do a better job on some aspects than D-Link, Linksys, TP-Link, and Zyxel. To sum it up, they said, much more effort is needed to make home routers as secure as current desktop or server systems. Additionally, our evaluation showed that large-scale automated security analysis of embedded devices is possible today. We used the Firmware Analysis and Comparison Tool, FACT, and it worked very well for almost all firmware images and analyzed during this study. FACT is an open-source software available on GitHub, and I should mention that it was developed by Fraunhofer, the F of what is now Firmware Analysis used to stand for Fraunhofer before they decided to open it to the public. So, what does this mean? Is it good? No. Is it the end of the world as we know it? Also no. Everyone knows that my blanket recommendation would be to use a current build of pfSense, which is built on top of state-of-the-art FreeBSD, and load it onto a little fanless multi-port appliance PC. You get a super solid platform that's not being continually updated because there are no known problems. If there were, they'd be fixed, and the darn thing will do anything you might wish for. Okay, so first of all, the comparison with a consumer PC is not fair because a Windows or a Mac or a Linux, it has to be secure against all the random application crap that people run on that OS. Thank goodness a router is only running its own fixed firmware. It is not a host to, you know, randomly added consumer software, or it would be the end of the world as we know it. But it is, for what it's worth, it at least is an appliance. Okay, so it's not pfSense running FreeBSD. Everyone already has something that they like. They've got a router that they're using. So what I'll note here is that the one thing Fraunhofer failed to mention, unless any of these 127 routers is misconfigured to expose vulnerable open ports and services to the public internet, which could happen. So let's assume that isn't the case. And that isn't what they're looking at anyway in this study. All of these vulnerabilities are internal and accessible only from the LAN side of the router, not the WAN side. Okay, so a router has a hard-coded private key. That's not as cool as if it generated a random key the first time it was turned on, so that then every router of that make and model and firmware edition would be uniquely keyed. But it's not the end of the world either. That's not to say that this is good, but remember, we were recently talking about a router vulnerability that was so egregious that hostile code running on a web page in the user's browser could be used to reach out to the router and cause some trouble. But in general, once you have hostile code running loose inside your network, things are already bad. Note that all of the vulnerabilities cited by Fraunhofer require access to the router. So one way to secure the router would be to block access to the LAN side management services, except from, for example, one specific LAN IP. With pfSense, that's trivially done through its web-based UI. I don't recall seeing that generally available in consumer routers, but if it were, use it. If you were to block management to a specific IP, no system on the LAN could access the router's management, period. You could have a separate pokey old laptop that's no longer useful for much else as your router management PC. Its IP would be hard-coded, and it would be your router management laptop that's normally turned off and in a closet. With pfSense or some other advanced router, you could even give the LAN interface a second IP on a different private network, like a 10 dot. That way, the router's management would not even be on the same network. It wouldn't be in the same Ethernet broadcast domain as any of the other services on the LAN. Or you could use VLAN tagging and place a cheap little VLAN-aware smart switch in front of the router to block any access to the management traffic's VLAN that wasn't tagged with the proper VLAN tag. And, of course, that would only work for wired traffic. Well, I guess, you know, you could do VLAN over Wi-Fi, come to think of it. So there's another solution. Bind the management to a wired port or to a VLAN Wi-Fi that cannot be seen by management. So anyway, you get the idea. Many solutions are available depending upon your network and its configuration. It's true that consumer routers are a problem. That's worth keeping in mind. Older routers, like older smartphones, may no longer be receiving updates, and they may be more of a problem, especially if, you know, problems become known that are never going to be fixed in your router's firmware. But the problem is not existential, and a bit of thought given to strictly limiting all inside access in the same way that the WAN side is strictly limited or it'd be the end of the world, that might just pay off. If nothing else, for your peace of mind. So, you know, it's worth looking at, you know, poking at your router's UI features and see, for example, if you can put a filter on the router's port 80 or hopefully port 443, the TLS connection port. Although I don't know if I've seen a router that supports HTTPS. I think I've seen some that actually do allow themselves to get a cert from
over the ACME protocol. It's often a self-signed
from Let's
cert.
Encrypt.
Yeah, sometimes yeah. they just do a self-signed cert.
And so you get
certs.
Warning notices.
So you say,
and, oh my
yes,
God.
But I am trying to contact this router, so right. let me in. And then you've exchanged certs, so from then on it's a secure conversation. You just have to be careful that right. first time, right?
Right. You say, yes, I will trust something from right. this self-signed the device. Yeah,
I've seen that.
So a little bit of miscellany, Leo. I just wanted to mention, I was grumbling about the price hike of YouTube TV. Well, I uncanceled my subscription to it.
Oh, really? Sling, you
I
mean?
Was, yeah. I
oh,
was
you uncanceled YouTube because you were going to move to Sling, right?
Right. I was going to move to Sling.
It's not very good.
I didn't make it very far since I really, really, really need the recorded content scrubber to work correctly.
Right.
Working correctly means that you can pause the content and then jump forward or backward by some amount of time, and you get to see a thumbnail of where you now are. It's critical for the way I watch content. And YouTube TV works exactly like that on my Roku. I get to pause it, and then I can, like, you know, jump forward and backward, typically over the commercial, until I see that the show has started again. Then I'll back up one frame and unpause. It's perfect. Sling TV works in that annoying, progressively faster and faster. If you push the fast forward or fast reverse or, you know, button either way, but it's totally blind. You can't see where you are. So anyway, no fixed time jumping and no thank you. I just said, it would have saved me some money, but it's worth it for me to pay the extra monthly fee in order to get, you know, movement through pre-recorded shows the way I think.
And a much better selection of channels. I have to say Sling's kind of scant in its offerings.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're just stuck, unfortunately.
And as you said, it's the standard bundling. It's right. just we have moved from cable delivery over to, streaming delivery. But,
still cable, maybe someday, basically. It's the same price model.
Maybe someday somebody will challenge the bundlers. Although I guess I don't know how that happens because bundles are bundles.
Right. It's the content guys who really determine it in the long run. And that's what they want. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So, Leo.
Yes.
I was reading a couple days ago about how the Linux team has approved new terminology, officially banning terms like blacklist and slave.
Right.
And of course, we've been touching on this topic of insensitive language and terminology in our technology. And, you know, I thought, why not do my part too? As I've been working on SpinRite's forthcoming technology, I've been thinking about our new woke awareness of the challenges faced by those in any highly heterogeneous culture and environment. Even when we're all created equal, we're all still created differently. So in that spirit, in a spirit of accepting these differences, I realized that labeling a sector as bad is really quite harsh. I mean, it's not really a bad sector. At the moment, it's just checksum challenged. It's error non-correcting or just having a weak bit. It's not bad. It's just different from its neighboring sectors. And so SpinRite's newly enlightened job will be to have a gentle conversation with the sector. SpinRite will check in with it to see how it's feeling. SpinRite will work with the sector to bring about the change that will be in everyone's long-term best interest. And you know, 4,096 bits is a lot of bits. Oh my goodness. So if it should turn out that this particular, otherwise beautiful and perfect little sector just can't get the hang of holding on to every one of those oh so many bits, well, then SpinRite will find a nice place for it to go so that it just doesn't need to worry about all that any longer. It's a lot after all. So it will be able to just rest and relax and live out the rest of its drive's life in peace. It will still be there, but a fresh and brand new sector will be taking over, handling all of its bits for it so that it just doesn't need to worry about all of that anymore. So in the future, SpinRite, we're not going to have any bad sectors. No, we're just going to have some that SpinRite decides have already worked as hard as they need to, and it's time to just give them a rest and give some brand new sectors that have been waiting all this time their own chance to hold on to all of those bits for their owner. It's 2020 after all, and this really feels much better.
You want to take a break before we get to the meat of the matter?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. Do you know how long well-qualified tech job candidates are on the job market? If you've got the skills, you've got the certs, its average is about 10 days. In fact, it's really, you'd be better calling it a bidding war than hiring. IT Pro TV is an engaging and effective online IT professional training platform. They're going to help guide you into the IT career of your dreams with all the support you need to be successful. Take courses for networking skills or security skills, Linux, Apple, and more. Earn certificates in A+, CCNP, and so many more, including CompTIA. IT Pro TV, did you know, is the official video training partner for CompTIA. It has 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. And with over 5,800 hours of IT training, IT Pro TV is the place to go for getting started or continuing in your IT career. Sign up for a premium membership. Let an expert guide you with setting goals and implementing an IT training program to help you reach them. IT Pro TV also has a learning coach for teams. Engage and grow the skill base of your team members through a corporate premium membership. Go to IT Pro TV and start to explore the different career paths, job resources, virtual labs, and practice tests so you can see for yourself the amazing opportunities you have to learn from the best professionals in the industry. If you want to learn a little more, go to IT Pro TV and catch their podcast, Technado. Don Pezet's doing a podcast featuring industry guests and IT news recaps. Oh, that's awesome. Technado. I like the name. July is IT Pro TV's CompTIA month. They're going to have a CompTIA-themed, actually several CompTIA-themed webinars, a free CompTIA training weekend, free, and a CompTIA-themed game show. Oh, boy. CompTIA guests on their podcasts and more. Go to IT Pro TV. Join a community. See how it is. It really is a community of IT pros who are sharpening their skills the fun way. Go to itpro.tv/securitynow. Use the code SN30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/securitynow. And use the code SN30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. Steve?
Boy, that is a good deal.
Oh, it's a really good deal. Yeah, they're great.
So it's not a technado, Leo. It's a tsunami.
Don's show is a technado, but this, a tsunami.
This is a tsunami.
Which is so probably just as bad.
This I think, is going to be very interesting, of interest to our listeners, and another really good thing that Google has done. I mean, look at Chromium and what that has meant for the industry's browsers. Google has open sourced a vulnerability scanner for large-scale enterprise networks, which is not to say that it can't be used for smaller networks, but I'll explain why this is. It's what they've been using. It's for large-scale enterprise networks consisting of thousands or even millions of internet-connected things. I've got two links in the show notes, both GitHub links, because, yes, that's where this thing lives. Google has named it Tsunami. They've been using it themselves internally at Google, and it has recently been made available to us all. And I'm sure before long we'll have like pre-packaged binaries for all of our popular OSs. It's not going to be a Google-branded product, but it will be maintained, further developed, and extended by the open-source community. Very much in the way Google first made Kubernetes available. And, you know, it's just, and that just became a staple in the industry. Of course, as we know, hundreds of other commercial or open source vulnerability scanners already exist in the world. The difference here, what Tsunami is doing, is that Google built the scanner with very large enterprise deployment in mind, like its own. I mean, Google uses it. So this is not to suggest, as I said, that it would not be just as useful for smaller environments, but that it's inherently designed to scale well. And this is critical. It is explicitly designed to absolutely minimize the production of false positive detections, which can be which unfortunately scale just as the network scales. It turns out that false positives are the bane of IT personnel when traditional scanners are let loose across a large enterprise. So Tsunami was designed to run inside giant networks where even the slightest false positive findings could result in sending incorrect patches to hundreds or thousands of devices, possibly resulting in crashes, network crashes, countless wasted work hours. So Tsunami is designed instead to gracefully tackle networks which may include hundreds of thousands of servers, workstations, networking equipment, and IoT devices that are connected to the internet and visible to the scanner, all while providing the highest possible scanning accuracy with an eye toward minimizing false positives. They said that they designed Tsunami with the ability to adapt to extremely diverse and extremely large networks without the normal need to run different scanners for each device type, as is typically done and is too often necessary. They did this by splitting Tsunami into two logically and operationally separate pieces. The first component is the scanner. They call that the reconnaissance module. It scans a company's network for open ports and tests each port, attempting to identify the protocols and services running on each to prevent mislabeling ports and testing devices for the wrong vulnerabilities. Its port fingerprinting module was derived from Nmap, the legendary network mapping engine. But then they added to that a bunch of their own new code to the Nmap core. The second component is the more complex of the two. It takes this, the first component, the scanner mapper's output, as its input. It takes each located device and its exposed port, selects from a list of vulnerabilities to test, and runs benign exploits to determine whether the device is actually vulnerable to that attack. This is the vulnerability verification module, the primary means through which Tsunami may be extended because it uses a flexible plugin architecture to allow the entire vulnerability verification module to grow over time and evolve through straightforward community extension. And it will allow security teams to add new attack vectors and vulnerabilities to check inside their own networks. So you can imagine, for example, when news of this Chinese C-Data fiber terminator vulnerabilities became public, someone might quickly add a vulnerability verifier to Tsunami in order to see whether there are any of those exposed and vulnerable and to locate any that are. So, for example, you would immediately, out of that public disclosure, you would add those four new username password pairs and I don't know even whether it's open on Telnet 23 or some other port, but whichever port, you would add that, quickly create a Tsunami module, probably taking an existing Telnet vulnerability scanner and just adding a few more lines to it, and then turn it loose. And you may have already, for example, run reconnaissance on your network, so you would have a global network map already established. So you would just then run that new vulnerability module driven by the reconnaissance input against your network in order to immediately locate and start dealing with a newfound problem. So at the moment, at release time, Tsunami comes with plugins which check for exposed sensitive interfaces, applications such as Jenkins, Jupyter, and Hadoop Yarn ship with UIs that allow a user to schedule workloads or to execute system commands. If these systems were exposed to the internet without authentication, attackers could leverage the functionality of the application to execute malicious commands. So that's an example of something that you could use this to make sure you're safe against. And also it checks for weak credentials. It uses other open source tools such as NCrack to detect weak passwords used by protocols and tools, including SSH, FTP, RDP, and MySQL. So with this public release of Tsunami, Google is not by any means stepping away from the project. They plan to continue enhancing it for their own use with new plugins to detect an ever-widening variety of exploits, and those will be contributed back to the community. There'll be a separate Tsunami plugin repository that they create. Google said that it will focus on meeting the goals of high-end enterprise clients like itself and the conditions found in these types of large and diverse multi-device networks. So anyway, I wanted to put this on our listeners' radar. It looks like a very cool piece of new technology donated by Google to the IT users of the world for our use. And I haven't had any chance to play with it, but I'm sure we will start seeing tsunami binaries that will make it easy for people to play with.
Cool.
Very cool. And nice. Thank you once again, Google.
Google does good stuff. Those security guys especially do good stuff.
Yeah.
Steve, we've come to the end of another thrilling, gripping edition of Security.
775 podcasts in the can.
Only 225 to go. Well, 224 to go. Maybe I can talk you into doing an episode 1,000 just, you know, without any numbers or something.
Well, or zero. We never did zero.
Got to do the zero. Yeah, it resets to zero. Then we start all over again. We do the show every Tuesday right after Mac Break Weekly. That's about 1:30 usually. Yeah, it's going to be a little later often. But 1:30 Pacific is the goal, 4:30 Eastern time. That's 20:30 UTC. Here's the deal. You can watch us do it live. If you go to twit.tv/live, there's the audio and video streams there. But you can also get on-demand versions of the show. Steve has them at his website. He actually has some unique versions of it, a 16 kilobit audio version, for instance, along with the 64 kilobit, the normal audio. He also has a transcript of every show, which is a really useful tool either for reading along while you listen or for searching, because you can search right into any show by searching the transcript of that. That's all at grc.com. While you're there, take a look at Spinrite 6, the current version, 6.1 on its way. If you buy now, you'll be participating, if you wish, in the beta of 6.1, and you can weigh in on various features. There's a lot of freebies associated with that as he spins off concepts and ideas. That's all at grc.com. He's also on Twitter, and if you want to leave a question for Mr. G., you see that Twitter handle right there, at SGGRC. He accepts DMs from anybody. You can also get copies of the show at our site, twit.tv/SN. We have video as well as audio, twit.tv/SN. And, of course, we always encourage you, if you can, to subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That way you don't even have to think about it. Just whenever you're in the mood for Security Now, there it will be, ready, queued up to listen to. Thanks, Steve. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and a rotating crew of Android journalists, developers, and enthusiasts, where we talk about the latest news, hardware, and apps for the Android faithful. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/AAA or find the show in your podcatcher of choice. That's All About Android. Security Now.